Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. My guest today is the writer, filmmaker and women's health campaigner Kate Muir. Until perimenopause struck, Kate was the chief film critic of The Times. Then all hell broke loose, as anyone who's found themselves in the midst of the perimaelstrom will understand. Her life and her job underwent massive turmoil. Now at the other side, she has produced two smash hit documentaries for Channel 4 about the menopause with Davina McCall and followed that up with Davina's Pill Revolution. Alongside that, she has written two books, Everything You Need to Know About the Menopause But We're Afraid to Ask, and now Everything You Need to Know About the Pill But We're Also Afraid to Ask. In short, Kate is a woman on a mission to demystify, educate, and empower women to have agency over their own body.
There are people ill and people needing help, but there's a sort of really raucous sisterhood thing going on. It's very empowering, and I can walk into a room and we all tell one another everything in about 5 seconds.
A self-confessed lifelong troublemaker, Kate joined me to talk about the menopause bomb that made her upend her life. Going to film school at 50-ish, the story of her mum's last period, it's corker, and the HRT Alzheimer's equation. We also discussed the fatberg of gender bias consuming women's healthcare, why her daughter's contraception experience made her turn her attention to the pill, and the chameleon power of ageing.
I love what you're doing. I really enjoy it with my dog in the park. And there's just great voices. It's fantastic. It's really great.
And I'm really interested
that we're all in the same mindset to
yes.
get that. And it's astonishing, you know, that it's like we're a mushroom. Maybe I should say that, but we're, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
we've got all these spores.
Like we're spawning like fungus, yeah.
I think we are a bit. And I've not felt this before. But maybe I'll talk about that in the podcast a wee bit, about the kind of new sisterhood. It's a really interesting...
Yeah, well, let's just get started, because I think that I must have been writing The Shift around the same time as... Well, how old were you when you... had perimenopause, when you had your kind of perimaelstrom, as I like to call it?
51. Yeah, late 40s, early 50s. Yeah.
Because I think now I look back, I think there were so many of us going through it in isolation. And it was that going through it in isolation that led to this for me, and obviously led to it for you
as well.
Yeah, I had no idea what was going on at all. And, you know, it was an astonishment to me that I could not Google what was happening to me and that I was an investigative journalist. Yes. And somehow there was nothing there. And I still Google things and there's nothing there. And I think, we need a research institute for that.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because I one of the reasons I wrote Shifters. I just felt like, do you know what, if I am a magazine, I was a magazine editor. I had access to a bloody health editor. And it still came as a complete shock to me.
Yeah.
It's like, so how was it for other women? Awful. Even more awful.
And I think it's still awful for lots of women who are not on the access to Instagram and media that we are. And there are these huge pockets of silence and darkness and people just floundering around, particularly in perimenopause, when no one knows what's happening to them. They think nothing is happening to them and they blame themselves. And I've only realized that, you know, my head is completely controlled by hormones in the last 10 years. You know, I should have guessed that. But no, you know, I just didn't understand the power of what was happening when those hormones left the building. I didn't get it. No idea.
No. So did you?
I didn't know what the hormones were even.
Yeah, they were just, I mean, it probably makes me sound really ignorant, but to me, estrogen, it was just all about pregnancy.
I know, and you know, I have a vague sense there was progesterone, just, and I didn't know about testosterone, had no idea that was a female hormone, still convincing people that that is a female hormone with the science. And that's this huge bulk, it's like a fat burg of gender bias that we are just pushing against. And it's women themselves also are trapped in this fatberg and don't understand the science and haven't been told the science. And I'm really keen, to my surprise, as a novelist, on data, on science, on proof, because that is the only way. And then the other way to get through is to do what you're doing, which is tell women's stories back to them. Because that's how we learn, and that's how we believe. We trust other women who we trust in other areas, and then we believe their menopause story or whatever it is.
Tell me about your experience, because it has radically changed your life, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, my perimenopause, I suppose, which I didn't know the word for, and the word only recently went on the NHS website properly. But my perimenopause, I had the complete car crash. So I basically, the things that really finished me off were I had heart palpitations, which were keeping me up in the middle of the night. And I'd wake at 4 a.m. with incredible anxiety and cartoon palpitations, you know, and I went to the doctor and, you know, I got, you know, an ECG and all the scans. And then they said, you're drinking too much coffee, but you seem to be in good health. No mention of HRT, no mention of menopause and heart stuff. And then I was writing a shopping list one Saturday morning and I thought, and I've got this in my book, and I was writing thinking, must shave my legs. And I wrote down the word shaver and I thought took me 15 minutes to remember the word razor, and I knew there was another word for it, and it was a domestic noun. And my mum had just died of Alzheimer's, and I'd watched her losing noun after noun after noun over 10 years. And I can almost often tell when I'm talking to someone if they're coming close to getting Alzheimer's, older people, because I can tell with their vocabulary, because it reminds me of my mother's vocabulary, which is searching for another noun for the same thing. And I was desperate, and I rang all my friends, and of course they were all privately on HRT, not from their GPs, but privately. And a number of them were media editors in London, let us say, who had not talked about it in public at all because it was so aging. And that was the other thing. There was this secret world of elite people on HRT and the rest of the world didn't know about it and there was nowhere to read about it. And it was just like, what is going on here? And then I realized, you know, after a while talking to people about the mental health aspects of this, that this was possibly the greatest story I was going to come across as a journalist. And I was talking to people who had had electroconvulsive therapy because of their perimenopausal symptoms, you know, 12 sessions as an outpatient, had been unable to leave the house for 7 years, and then suddenly got on HRT and she walked her dog around the block for the first time. And when I heard that story, I thought, this is so powerful, so life-changing, and people like you and me had no idea, and we were doing the messages for women, the messaging for women. And that's when I thought, well, I'm just going to kick everything till I get this on the television. And so thus began the mad struggle.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I've just had a brain fog moment. So I was just going to say something to you and now it's all completely gone. But I think that the thing is that, you know, it's like all you knew about was hot flushes. And I don't know about you, but I had that couple of years where I was struggling with all the mental health things. And so I thought, you know, I'm going mad. It's like, have I got early onset Alzheimer's? You know, all of those things. And nobody told you that those were actually, if anything, more predominant symptoms than the things everybody knew about, which was just hot flushes. And I think it's interesting you say that all your friends said, oh, actually, they were on HRT, because I rang all my friends and they were like, oh, no. And they almost treated me like it was catching. It's almost like, oh, get away.
I think the big thing in this story is the mental health aspect and the brain fog and the confidence and the memory. I think that the same thing with the book I've done on the pill as well. A huge amount of that is on mental health. But in the menopause, you know, nobody had bothered to ask women about the mental health symptoms. They'd maybe ticked a box if they'd gone on antidepressants, but that was it. And luckily, we did with the Fawcett Society for the second Divina Menopause documentary, we polled 4,000 women about their symptoms. And it was diverse women all around the country, proper poll. And of course, the mental health symptoms were massive. And it was 84% sleepless, 73% brain fog. And it was just after COVID, actually. So it was 69% anxiety and depression, might be lower than that. But again, you are looking at anxious, depressed, sleepless people who are doubting their own strength of intellect because they are getting little blackouts as the estrogen is disappearing from their brain. Literally, they are losing these words. They are losing the white matter of connections. And I'm really interested in what's happening in the brain. But again, we were gaslighted about that. And what you could see from outside as a doctor was a woman went pink and sweated when she had a hot flush or her bed filled with sweat at night. And these things were measurable, but our own truth was not measurable until now. And indeed, I was very interested in my own truth in this poll. So I put in a question about the heart palpitations and it came back 44% of women had heart palpitations in menopause. Now, that is not what you read in the medical papers because nobody really bothers to properly cover it. But it was a huge thing. And all those women thought they were having heart attacks and panicking and they had thought there was something terrible wrong with them. And indeed, you've got to pay attention to it because there is a slight risk. You've got to go and, you know, find out about it. But I just had no idea.
No clue. I mean, so what was happening with you when you went into perimenopause? Were you still working at the Times? Were you still married? Because it really did put a bomb under everything for you, didn't it?
It did, didn't it? I don't entirely blame menopause for the bomb. I think the bomb was there. And there is something about losing hormones that makes us see ourselves more clearly because there are no comfortable buffers of mummy love and oxytocin and estrogen all around us. So you are quite raw. But yeah, so I was working at the Times. I was the chief film critic at the Times. And I got divorced after, you know, being in a relationship for 25 years. I'd gone off and moved into a flat by myself. My daughter, who was 15, was coming back and forth to that flat. I was just bare and raw. And my mum had just died of Alzheimer's, which was almost 10 years ago. And I hadn't processed any of that. And, you know, and I was just trying to hold it all together, as we all did. We all just thought, I thought I was fantastic at holding things together. And then I just lost the whole lot in the kind of overnight slam dunk that I created myself mostly. And then also I lost my job at the Times a couple of years later as the film critic. And I can't talk about that in public, but let's just say that my politics were increasingly different and very radical. And, you know, so it, you know, but that was great because in a sense I had this, you know, I had a chance, I had a payout, I had this time to stop and think. And I did up a falling apart house. I moved into it. I went to film school for 6 months and learned how to pitch and, you know, produce a script. And I decided, you know, with this sort of menopause stuff going on, I decided that was what was really, really mattering. And I met Dr. Louise Newson, who became my kind of scientific mentor and taught me how to read science papers. So it was almost like my whole life was completely pivoted in the direction of becoming, you know, a menopause kind of campaigner and indeed a women's health campaigner. And I'm just didn't expect that at all. Do you know what I mean? Didn't intend it, but it became necessary to do because the job had to be done. And I'm part of a huge movement of people now doing it. But I think people like you and I were out there shouting first, and we were the tipping point in the Malcolm Gladwell sense that there was this huge bulk of information ready to go and these huge feelings from women ready to be spoken about. And we just had to lift the lid a bit and it all came pouring out.
It did feel like that, didn't it? It's like nobody, it felt like nobody was talking about it. And then it was just a bit, it was a bit like you just like, just kind of took the lid up off and peered in and out it all came. But what made you, before the Davina documentary, which I, you know, really want to talk about, what made you go to film school? What was it that drove that? Because how old were you then? 50 odd?
52, 53, something like that. I'm 59 now. So yeah, it was something like that. I don't really know. I'd always wanted to, you know, I've written three novels and I kind of wanted to be able to make them into television. And there was a particular project I was working on that really required a team of people, which I've still got sort of on the back burner when I finish doing this. And, you know, it's set in Glasgow and I really do want to do it. But I just was carried away with having to kind of create a documentary, having not ever made one, which was a wee bit difficult, actually, to be honest.
So at film school, were you, what was the makeup of the class like? Because I can imagine people listening to this going, oh, I would love to do that, but I'd just be terrified because I'd be the only old person.
No, well, it was mostly script writing and it was weekends. So it wasn't like full time. And because I knew I couldn't, I was too late to be a director really in life, but I knew I could write. And so it was a mixed bag of 20-year-olds and 6-year-olds and people who were obsessed with outer space and people who wanted to write about their own disasters. And it had what they taught us to do, which was absolutely brilliant. They made us watch, because we were all coming in going, I've got this brilliant highfalutin idea. And he said, go and watch EastEnders, watch those episodes, watch what they do in 1 minute, track what they're doing in 1 minute, write scenes that finish in 1 minute, and, you know, think visually. And it was a brutal training, but it was really, really good because they basically taught us how to write kind of simple soap. And it's like writing journalism. Once you can write tabloid journalism, when I was at journalism school, of course you can write a big long piece for the FT or the Times because that's easy. It's condensing it and punching. And so it was really useful to learn that. And I had all these connections in the film world because I'd been this film critic and I'd also campaigned for women in Hollywood and women in film. So I had this big network of female filmmakers that I knew and loved and had partied with when, you know, 95% of films were directed by men. It's no longer the case, but it's almost the case.
Yes, it's not that much better now.
And so I'd campaigned. So everything in a kind of, you know, strangely destined way connected, I think, and all these skills became useful. And, you know, I'm really lucky. I mean, I realise that it's really great to have a thing you care about and you've got the skills to do something about, because that doesn't always happen.
No, absolutely not. What was the motivation? Was it your experience of not being able to find the advice? What was it that made you think, this needs to happen and I need to be the person to do it?
it was other women telling me their stories about mental health, in particular the ones who had been outpatients in mental hospitals. And it was understanding about hormonal depression and hormonal anxiety, which had not been explained. And I think one of the key things that we did in that first Davina McCall Sex Myths in the Menopause program was to get women to talk very publicly and emotionally. They were so emotional about their mental health as they crashed into perimenopause, which I always consider to be menopause's dastardly little sister, because you don't know it's there. And it was telling them that. And, you know, after doing that, I think so many, many hundreds and hundreds of women have contacted me and said, I was going to kill my husband for eating crisps, couldn't bear the sound he made.
Too loud.
I was going to leave him, you know. And people have said, I was suicidal. I just have given up my job. And the numbers of people whose lives turned around, and we know statistically now that 1 million more women in the UK went on HRT since those two documentaries and the big menopause movement. I mean, it was a whole huge change. And that women began to understand that there were safer kinds of HRT and not just the old synthetic kind. And so that really was the thing. I don't know, it just all kind of pushed forward. And the other thing about doing that documentary was Davina herself. Actually, we started out with another presenter, and then there was lockdown and all sorts of stuff happened, and the Channel 4 cancelled it because they cancelled everything. And then we started again, and I rang her and I said, could you do this? And after an hour, she was driving her car home. She said, I can do this. And I was quite astonished. And there was something, oh, we've got Kat. Hello, Kat.
Yeah, hello, Kissage.
And there was something, what I realized afterwards, that Davina had this sort of river of fame that was already running from Big Brother and way back. And she had this household trust. And in a sense, we put these huge menopausal fish in her river.
Yes,
and they went along and they grew.
That's a good way of looking at it, actually.
And it was a thing. And she also really taught herself about it too. So it was, you know, that in itself was a sort of loaves and fishes miracle of communication that was just another matter of sort of chance as well, but it all kind of came together.
The need was so great, wasn't it? But because there's so much pressure on women not to age, not to admit that they're aging, you know, definitely not to pass 40 in the workplace, and God forbid you pass 50. And so it's almost, I mean, going back to your analogy about taking the lid off, it's almost like there were just all these women kind of bottling it up because, you know, it was expected at work by the men at work or by actually the younger women at work as well, you know, who didn't really want to know about it. But also, I mean, I don't know, were you aware of your mum's menopause or the other women in your family?
Yeah, well, oddly, my mum, she only told me one thing about it, and that was her final period. And she was eventually a personnel manager in a department store in Glasgow. And she had one of those offices that was sort of a glass cubicle in the middle of the store. And she had the biggest period ever on her chair as she sat at her desk. She just completely flooded. It was literally a puddle under her desk, and she didn't know it was coming. And it was those famous last periods that you get, and all the women in the office surrounded her and taped up newspaper on that glass partition and came in and cleaned it up and got her new clothes and stuff like that. And I just wanted to cry. And that was the only thing she ever told me, because we only associate menopause with the end of our periods. And of course, I never thought to ask, really. And I sort of experienced most of it after she died. So I didn't realize, but I was incredibly aware when I was clearing out her stuff after she died, and she had endless documents on thyroid problems, which she didn't have, but she'd underlined things in wobbly hand about, and thyroid symptoms can be really similar to menopause symptoms. And she'd obviously known there was something wrong. And, you know, people with, you know, lots of hot flushes, which she did get, are most at risk for Alzheimer's. We know that now because the hot flushes tend to increase the numbers of amyloid plaques that build up, as does sleeplessness. So you've got lots of sleeplessness, you've got lots of hot flushes. The two intersect and nobody quite knows why, but it means your brain is basically not taking out the recycling at night and you're at a much higher risk. And sort of also when I realized there was as a child of Alzheimer's, you think, oh my God, there's nothing I can do about this. You know, it's a horrible thing to be looking at in the future. And then suddenly when I was researching that menopause book, I came across paper after paper in quite obscure places about Alzheimer's and estrogen and how estrogen protected the brain and how women who had early hysterectomies were more likely to get Alzheimer's and things like that. So it was quite clear there was a story here and we wanted to keep our natural hormone for as long as possible. And then when you think, well, we could give ourselves back that natural hormone, and how is that going to affect our brains? And Dr. Lisa Moscone has done this amazing book called The Menopause Brain, which kind of explains that. But, you know, again, are people racing to do that science? Is anyone doing it? You know, a 20-year trial on body identical estrogen and Alzheimer's? I don't think so, because it's not worth pharmaceutical companies paying for it, because, you know, they don't make any money out of HRT because it's a product of nature. It's not patentable.
It's so depressing, isn't it?
But if I can tell as many people in the world as possible about the connection between estrogen and Alzheimer's, that will have been worth it. You know, I really, really care about doing that. And the other longevity things around HRT, and the Menopause Charity has done a brilliant paper on this about long-term health and HRT, and osteoporosis, massive. You know, estrogen increases your bone density, as does testosterone. You know, type 2 diabetes, really good. You know, cardiovascular disease, basically the good estrogens, you know, stops you clagging up and getting clots and getting strokes. So it's such a brilliant piece of science that's coming to us, but lots of people don't yet believe it. It's literally flat earth out there, I think. And the people talking about alternatives and soy, and you're going, yeah, but let's just measure what soybean does compared to your own natural hormone, and it's not going to stop you going blind or getting macular degeneration. I mean, it is amazing, the science, and I'm going to do the next book on that, and I'm really excited about.
Yeah, you're getting really like hyped up about it.
Well, it's great, isn't it? It's really good news, and the idea we're not sitting there accepting the good news and researching it is it says a great deal about what we think of older women.
Absolutely. I mean, what you were saying just then about kind of being a daughter of dementia, I've got a friend who's all of the older women in her family have had dementia. So her mum, her aunt, her gran. And I just, you know, and she was saying quite recently, it feels like that's it. I am, you know, me and my sister, we're definitely going to get it. No two ways. And so I think just this conversation about the fact, well, what are these connections, and the fact that it can be such a huge life changer for people if, you know, if this is a reason to take HRT. Is there any scientific proof yet?
There's not really good randomized controlled trials. We've got someone on a placebo and someone on the HRT. But what we do have is huge studies of American health databases from insurance. And there's one done by Roberta Diaz-Brinton, who has been studying estrogen in women's brains for 30 years. And she looked at over 400,000 women and looked at their HRT patterns. And she found that those on transdermal HRT, much better than the old HRT, had a 73% less likely chance of getting dementia and Alzheimer's. That's a good number for me, 73%. I like that. And there are other bits and pieces. But the problem with this whole story of HRT is that lots and lots of people, particularly in the medical establishment, which really shocks me, talk about the old version of HRT, which has synthetic progestins in it. And the one in the big trial that frightened everybody 20 years ago had, you know, pregnant mare's urine. That's where they extracted the estrogen from. So it was a very different drug, and it was a drug. And what we are offering women is not really a drug. It's a copy exactly of their own hormones to top up their own hormones.
I mean, you and I were talking, was it last week, week before, emailing about, you know, the backlash, which is the inevitable backlash, which I think, you know, we were all expecting. But, you know, coming from really creditable places, you know, like there was a BBC documentary that was absolutely, you know, the entire thing was absolutely stacked against HRT. I mean...
Well, I'll tell you what's happening, which I think is what's happening. So there was a big Lancet piece with four pieces written by Martha Hickey. And it basically said this menopause is being over-medicalized. And now we know that is not true because 80% of women in Britain are not on HRT and 95% of women around the world are not in HRT. So that, in a sense, is even rubbish just as a sentence. But there is very much, people are terrified of the cost of HRT here on the NHS. And because a million more women, due to the big menopause movement, are on HRT, it costs about £120.
That's actually your fault, Kate, okay, you know. I know. Davina gets the blame, but it's entirely. Your fault.
But certainly a catalyst in trouble. But so it's probably costing the NHS £120 million more to get HRT to these other women, the new HRT fans. And they are hoping that women will just get on with it quietly. And they are unable to see the bigger picture that £120 a year spent on one woman saves £12,000 on her hip replacement in 10 or 15 years' time. And if you sent in The Economist magazine to analyse the situation, they would tell the NHS that every time a woman goes on HRT, you know, there's this just massive saving. You can hear the ker-ching because they're not going back to the doctor seven times for sore joints or arthritis or depression or, you know, dry eyes or macular degeneration. You know, it's not going to save you from everything in old age unless you lead a healthy life. It is not, as they say, a magic bullet, but my God, it'll lift you up to a sort of 50% level.
Why are GPs, you know, and I'm not GP bashing for everybody who's about to write in and tell me I am. I really, really am not. I wouldn't want to be a GP for all the money in the world. But they're not reluctant to prescribe antidepressants. You know, it's like the first thing you're offered. So what is the reluctance?
It's lack of education, I think. And the younger generation of GPs, I was at a GP conference a couple of weeks ago, and the menopause sessions, people were handbagging one another to get in, literally. And they couldn't get in. All the menopause sessions were really, really full, most of them. And they were desperate to get the knowledge and how to prescribe HRT. And none of it's simple. You've got to, you know, you've got to titrate this stuff. And guess what? Every woman's hormones are different. Who knew? And, you know, you can't give them the one HRT in the same numbers to each woman. And, you know, the idea that that's what it says we should do is quite funny. But I am very hopeful because I just looked at the NHS website today. And from saying HRT, basically you put HRT into the website 5 years ago and it would say the risks of breast cancer are high, but you may take HRT. And that was basically the first sentence. And it was the old HRT. And now they have a whole HRT hub. You can go on, find out all about it. And it explains the transdermal and the safer and the ones that don't cause clots. And I just think, yeah, I mean, I don't know how many people look at the NHS website, but it's there. It's there.
No, but that's incredible. I mean, I think when I was looking, when you were looking, I mean, there was nothing. There was not. I mean, there was stuff like there were Facebook groups and, you know, but there were that kind of accessible, reliable information. It just wasn't there.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So you have you always been a troublemaker, Kate?
Yeah. Yeah, ever since my days in student politics at Glasgow University, and I was on the student magazine. And actually my first act of journalism was I was a law student when I was 17. I think this was maybe when I was 18 at Glasgow University. And everybody in first year failed their contract law because you had to buy the big book every year. Written by the guy. And I think back then it cost about £30, probably £120. You know, it was the big fat textbook. And he always put a new case in it, which he tested you on that wasn't in the lectures. So basically, I realized this and I passed the exam second time round and really swatted it up. But I realized there were people taking it 10 or 11 times and it, you know, he wasn't teaching us what he was asking questions about. And unless you could afford the book, you weren't getting anywhere. So I went and found out the statistics of exam failures around Scotland. And of course, it turned out to be the most failed exam. We wrote the news story and we took it to the university. And, you know, they did change the exam so that the content of the lectures would actually reflect what was in the exam. I was very pleased with that. But then I had a job in Byers Road in Guy's Delicatessen on Saturdays. That was my how I made money when I was a student. And I remember the professor coming in. He was called Professor Walker, and he came in and I thought, God, what if he knows it's me? And I was slicing Parma ham for him on the machine. And I nearly lost a finger, you know, because I was so terrified of the great kind of institution coming into my deli. I thought it was going to kill me, but I had no idea who it was. So it was fine. But I realized the effect of journalism at that point in my life. And also that it was quite fun, because a lot of this is quite fun. I mean, you know, there are people ill and people needing help, but there's a sort of really raucous sisterhood thing going on, which I am really enjoying. And I feel like I'm, you know, back then when I was a student, and it's very empowering. And I can walk into a room and we all tell one another everything in about 5 seconds. In the way that people confess things all the time on your podcast. Do you know what I mean?
All the small talk just drops away and it's just like you're straight in there and you just make those decisions and you're having those conversations really, really quickly in a way that you just didn't in your 20s and 30s. And I don't know, you know, well, there are lots of reasons, lots of things it could be. And it could be to do with the fact that, you know, in your 20s and 30s, you're focused on so many other things. But I think it's really, really noticeable at this age.
And there's a real sort of joyful energy. And I mean, I was like involved in, I lived in New York for a while. I was involved in kind of the third wave of feminism in New York and meeting in fashionable lofts and things like that. You know, it was all very, all very good fun. But this feels like that again. And it's all over. It's not just us in our bubble. It's the people dealing with endometriosis who are much younger. You know, the fact that, you know, adenomyosis did not appear on the NHS website until last year, despite the fact that 1 in 10 women get it. And you think, whoa.
I'd never even heard of it until my gynecologist told me I had it.
Oh, did you have it?
Yeah, and I didn't know. So when Nagin Mongeti started talking about it last year. I know I wrote a piece about it because she's the only other person I'd ever knew who had it. And, you know, and I had loads of people saying to me, what is it? And when I explained, they were like, oh, that's interesting, because I've got this, that and the other, and I've never had a solution for it.
And there's so many of that, and that's so important. But just think, the two of you talked about it, that's it. And as far as we know, 1 in 10 women have it. I don't even know how we know 1 in 10 women have it. But it is, I keep thinking about this and the effect it has on our lives, on our health, on the fact that we can't necessarily hold down a full-time job or whatever. And that this hormonal kind of string through our lives, which, you know, going right up to menopause, and that it's just been tugged by other people, and mostly those other people have been men. And that the science around this stuff is shockingly sloppy, a lot of it. I mean, some of it's brilliant, but nobody has questioned the science or looked at it. And it's very hard for journalists to do that, because you've got to get right into an area. You know, it's like being an expert on politics or something. And of course, you know, a science correspondent's got to be an expert on all science and all medicine. And it's only when you dig in. And I always believe, basically, you read a science paper, it was true, it'd been peer reviewed. And then you look at the peers who are reviewing some of these papers, and, you know, they're really very, very dodgy people. And you think, you've got to look into all the bottom lines here and the numbers, and it's like a constant search for the truth, which is kind of really gripping when you kind of find out somebody's kind of faking it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as a words person my whole life, I spent a lot of my life completely suckered by the belief that there was something kind of more powerful, more serious, more right about numbers. And that's partly because numbers people tell you that they're better than you because you're a words person. And I remember once having a boss, and we'd done the budgets for the year. This is when I was still kind of in the corporate machine. And we were in a meeting, and he went down the spreadsheet, just changing the numbers, just changing them with a red pen. And I went coming out and saying to the publisher, who is the kind of money person on the magazine, saying, "What? So he just changed the numbers to what he wanted them to be." And she said, "Oh yeah, that's the great thing about numbers. They don't really have to make sense." And I was like, "Well, actually, words are better than numbers, because words do have to make sense." And that was a real wake-up call for me. It's like, yes, data and numbers are really, really powerful, but you can make them say what you want them to say.
And the other thing, I thought exactly like you, because I was a journalist and a novelist and I was involved in film and all that, I just thought that was the bit of my head that worked. And I had no idea that the science bit of my head was asleep. And, you know, I'd done science at school, but, you know, you get sent in one direction or the other. You're not allowed to be both. And the idea that you could look at the stories in science, which is basically what we were doing, and dig things out of that and find truths and find lies and find plots in the science is really, really, you know, it's kind of gripping. And I just didn't think I had the skills to do that. But I think once you're through menopause and all that, you're like, I don't care. My hormones are the same every day. I'm a Tesla. I'm going to crush you. And there is literally, there's so, you know, you're so out there and none of it matters, you know. So it is a liberation to take the risk and ask questions about what we've been told. And, you know, one of the things I loved about actually doing my next book was I was researching Katharina Dalton, who in 1953, she's a doctor at UCL, discovered PMS and labelled it and worked out that the people with the big hormone dip just before their periods got PMS, what it was, and was topping them up with a little bit of progesterone, natural progesterone, which is what we use in HRT now, and stopping them feeling so crap. And she only realised it when her own migraine stopped in pregnancy, when her hormones changed in pregnancy. And I want her to get a blue plaque, because she died in 1994, so she's up for 20 years outside UCL. But, you know, it's people like that who have kind of disappeared, but their stories are amazing. And what she did for women by identifying the existence of that feeling that we could only talk about as a feeling and making it science, you know, it really, really helps to have labels. And, you know, she gave us that label. And, you know, far, far more important than any Nobel Prize, I would imagine, in many ways, you know.
Yeah, well, far more significant to most women's lives, definitely. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the new book in a moment. But before I do, how much do you think you've changed since coming out of perimenopause, since being a menopausal woman?
Oh, God, I'm so much happier and I'm so much more creative and I've got time for my brain to spend a lot of time on my work and really care about that. Whereas before, I think it wasn't just perimenopause, but having three children and all these responsibilities and looking after a husband and all these other things that one had to do, you know, in some sense that's all gone. And I feel my brain working differently. And I was talking to a friend who's an artist about this, who's also postmenopausal, really. She said, we were saying, is there a side brain? You have another brain that's working away quietly on stuff. And it's like having a second head and it suddenly pops up and says, you should do a play about this, or you should do a book about this, or, you know, we could go and campaign about this. And it brings forth a fully formed idea. And I realized that side brain in previous parts of my life was, you know, wasn't really, it was busy multitasking, keeping the other world and lots of other people happy, and often people who I loved, my children and everybody, but it was working hard at doing that other thing. And I could do the thing I had to do, which was write a story to a deadline for a newspaper. So I was able to do that sort of sensible thing, earn money, but that creative side brain really wasn't working in the way it is. So I think that's the difference. And I've got a new partner and it is just, so it's a different life. And, you know, I'm just kind of quite bouncy in a way, you know, and I'm not exhausted, you know, and I don't quite know why that is. I think there's a lot of other decisions you make. Like I stopped drinking, not that I drank a lot, because I was a good drinker, being a Glaswegian. It wasn't like I had a, you know, I was solid, but I just couldn't really tolerate it anymore. And my new partner doesn't drink, and I didn't want to be on a different planet from him. And that is actually surprisingly okay. I really like it.
Yeah, if you'd asked me 10 years ago if I could envisage ever giving up drinking, I would have just laughed in your face. I'd rather have given up almost anything but alcohol. But since I've had the odd drink, but I haven't really drunk for a year and I don't miss it at all.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And it's not like you're losing something. Most of the time you're gaining something because you're kind of seeing everything in full colour all the time. And the idea that you weren't kind of, you know, the idea that it made things better, I don't think it necessarily does. It does at dinner parties at 10 o'clock when people start talking rubbish or having fights or getting very giggly and you are just one step behind and you can't quite crack it. So you sometimes just have to just sit through that and hold. But otherwise, you know, that's not really you. That's just where you are. But I find it, I really like it, actually. It's weird. I think it's weird.
I've definitely discovered that I kind of, if I have to go to a party, I'm not a party lover anyway, but I do kind of have a couple of hour cut-off point. I do get to about 10 or 11, you know, and kind of think, okay, everybody's getting pissed now. I'm done here. But previously, I mean, obviously I would have been drinking with them, but also I just didn't have the capacity to leave. I was a terrible leaver. Even if I wanted to, I didn't. Whereas now I'm just like, bye, gone, finished, done here.
And like every cliched kind of 50-something women, I do the cold swimming and I go to Parliament Hill.
Another one.
And it's really sad. I'll tell you what makes me do it, though, is my really great friend, Deborah Ross, who is a film critic and columnist.
She's very, very funny.
She is hilarious.
Very funny. She's and great TV she, columnist.
She and I go swimming three mornings a week, sometimes with other people. But because we both have to get there from different places and the other person will be angry if the other person doesn't turn off at 7:30.
Yeah.
So it forces me to go.
So what was it that made you turn your attention to the pill? Is it just that you got so obsessed with data that you had to kind of find something else?
No, because again, this was like the menopause was the personal becoming political. Again, the pill was the personal becoming political. And it came out of my daughter, Molly, who was at Edinburgh University, actually, and came back home in lockdown, as they all did, and was in, you know, the basement, dark bedroom on Zoom trying to do lectures and just miserable, and got really depressed and you know, had been sort of just not very happy for a while, and really, really just didn't want to come up into the kitchen and have dinner. She just felt like she was darkening the room, she sort of said. And it wasn't just, you know, but then what happened was she ran out of her pill prescription from Edinburgh, and she didn't bother to renew it because she was down here in London. And about a month later, she bounced into the room a much, much happier person. She and I'd got her, like, I've managed to get her an art therapist online or something to try and sort of sort out what was going on. We realised that a good percentage of what was going on with her was related to the pill, and she was on the crappiest, cheapest pill, which was called Regivodon, which is kind of an androgenic, very basic pill. And the minute she came off it, she was much better. And she, and obviously I'm looking at the whole world through hormonal glasses, but I don't see her. And then I realized the stuff that's in the pill was the stuff that was in the bad HRT that we've now got rid of for older women. And I'm thinking, well, what does that do? You know, it's safer for younger women, but how does it work? And what does it do to your mental health? And what's been done on the pill? And she started researching it. And she started showing me her TikTok, which had all these young women unfurling enormous side effects leaflets and snuggling under them like blankets on TikTok. And lots of women saying, I've come off the pill, I feel so much happier. And there was lots of absolutely shocking misinformation on TikTok and on Instagram. It was rubbish. And about one in five of the posts were fictional science. And I started looking into it and the way they were interpreting it, and what it said in the, you know, the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health website, which is, you know, the series. And there was both this wild west of kind of opinions about the pill, and then this, everything's all right, stay calm, keep calm and carry on, keep taking it for as long as you can, and possibly swap pills if it's not okay, but that you're never going to put on weight and it really won't affect your mental health. It was that kind of voice was coming out. And then we tested the pill on women in Puerto Rico, and you look at this 256 women, which was, you know, because it was out of America, they could get away with it. And three of them died pretty well straight away once they were into the pill, and people were dying of strokes and clots, and they didn't investigate the reasons for the deaths. And then a quarter of them came off the pill because they were dizzy, because they were nauseous, all the things that are pre-clot, as we know. And then you discover that the levels of the pill being tested were 10 times the level of hormones we now have on the pill. And they took the remaining survivors and said, here's your science. No one got pregnant. And I was just incandescent. And, you know, I just thought it's been going on, you know, we celebrated it as our great liberation. And, you know, I was on the pill, you know, it was, I'm really happy about it in a sense. I got me through university, you know, I needed it. From the very beginning, we were abused and we were gaslighted and the science was made up. And when you think about that and think about the legacy of what's going on now and this huge new generation questioning on TikTok, the you know, there's an explosion happening that people are pretending to ignore. And I think it's just, it'll be a bit like the menopause. It'll be a whole big thing quite soon.
And it reminds me of millennials starting to talk about periods, you know, in our generation, having gone through our working lives, having to pretend not to be women, having to pretend not to have hormones or periods or any of those things. And, you know, a millennial started saying, oh, you know, I need to work from home because, you know, I have PMS or endometriosis or whatever, and that's just how it is. And then Gen Z doing the same with the pill. But I suppose what slightly worries me, I mean, I agree that the pill has just been like foisted on us, but, you know, the kind of trend for, what is it called, green sex, i.e. not using contraception, it's just a bit like, at a point when the backlash against abortion is becoming really, really sinister and concerning. So we're just going to see a return to loads of accidental pregnancy. And
I know it's like sort of weights pulling in all these different directions at once. And the American situation is I mean, unbelievable. I don't know why there aren't, every woman isn't out on the streets, you know, even more so. But then it just doesn't seem to happen, does it? It just, there's just this, I don't know. I find it astonishing what's not happening. The only equivalent for men is being conscripted into the army. But at least when they're conscripted into the army, they get fed and watered and paid and looked after. When you do this to a 14-year-old guy, you do this to a 14-year-old girl in Texas and tell her, you've got to keep that baby, sorry, you've been raped, and then put her out there. And then she has to look after the baby by herself. And the state is not providing it with food or money or, you know what I mean? There's no follow-up. It's just shame and horror.
The younger generations are much more outspoken. One of the things I certainly felt when I was perimenopausal was that there was no way I could envisage those young women just taking this lying down. But at the same time, yeah, there's bad stuff happening.
No, they'll be great. And the younger generation will be great. And I'm sure they will rock through it as long as they get out there and vote. You know, understanding that TikTok is great, but voting is really, really useful.
Voting also useful. Right. I'm going to ask you the questions I always ask at the end. What is your emotional age?
I think it is my age. I think I'm 59. And I feel very much like I did when I was in my 20s. Which I suppose it's an irresponsible age in that I'm not looking after children or having to do a full-time job or something like that. So in a sense, I feel my age. I like my age. I don't mind it.
Yeah. No, I really like being in my 50s. Really do. Give us a book recommendation.
Alistair Gray's Poor Things, which, as you know, is this fantastic film, but many people have not read the book. And I love the book. And I always loved Alistair Gray's Lanark. It was the first book I read after I'd finished my finals at university. And I saved it and saved it. And then I ran away and read it in the park. And, you know, I think it's a great work of American literature, Lanark. And I think Poor Things is an accessible way into Alistair Gray's work. And, you know, it's really clever and gothic and complicated in an entirely different way from the film. And, you know, some of it's questionable, but I loved it, loved it.
What advice would you give younger women?
Be honest. Be completely honest in every situation, even if you think it's going to cause trouble for yourself. Because I felt throughout my life, I tended to quieten things down sometimes and not be utterly honest. And now that I'm very honest about everything, I think it's a better way to live.
Who is your old bird role model?
Oh, I was thinking about that. Well, I love Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I also love Simone de Beauvoir. And I loved her throughout my life. I've grown up with her books, and I've just recently read parts of her book on old age. And one of the things she says about growing older is we must change as we grow older, or else we'll become parodies of ourselves. And I think that's really important. You know, Botox will not help, but my God, changing into being a chameleon, changing, becoming a new creature, you know, will be really interesting. So I love her.
Have you had Botox?
No.
You say that like it's obvious, but it's not.
All right. I'll come closer to the camera.
What's your superpower?
People tell me things. I just sit there and somehow they tell me things. And I think that, no, it wasn't so much previously, but I think now when you're in this sort of world where you're talking very honestly about people's health and you've given your own story over to the world, and then you say, I'll check what I'm saying, you know, what I'm writing about you. And then it's like being a priest in a confessional.
I quite like it. Just as well.
You know? Yes, considering what you have to do every week.
Last one, how many fucks do you give?
Absolutely loads until this whole movement gets this message out about longevity and HRT preventing certain diseases. I think it's so important. It's the best thing ever for women's health in recent times. So I'm going to give a fuck.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy The Shift and would like to show your appreciation, why not buy me a coffee? Go to www.buymeacoffee.com/theshiftwithsambaker. You can hear a new episode of The Shift every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please do rate, review, follow, tell your friends, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to know more about my own experience of shifting, my book, The Shift,
How I Lost and Found Myself After 40, and You Can Too, is out now in paperback.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.